together in a unique annual showcase.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second night of Millennial 8. The schedule this evening is... Hold on a second. I should have had that up. Hold on a minute. It's obviously in 2 hours will be the Course of Empire, Canadian commentator, then the Bizarchives, and then the Distributist. But first, I'm here with Greg Johnson of Countercurrents. Greg, welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you for having me back. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. And one thing that is worth saying is that you are one of only two people who have appeared on every Millennial.
Would that include you?
Obviously me as well, but I should say guests who have appeared on every year of Millennial. It's you and Jared Taylor.
A best company. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. I guess Frody and Lichtmess first appeared in 2017. So otherwise they would be joining you there. So anyway, welcome back. And it has been a fairly full year. And you said you just wanted to review the year of 2022. What would you say are the salient things that have happened this year?
Well, I think it's great at the end of the year to take some time to review the previous year. And that's one of the things that I like about Millennial, aside from providing good cheer and introducing a lot of people to talents in the movement. It's always sort of a talent show for me. I'm always discovering new people through Millennial, so I very much appreciate that. But I think it's important to have a time to pause and gather your thoughts and look back over the year, and I've been doing that. It's still super stressful right now. There's just so much to be done before Christmas, but between Christmas and New Year's especially, I like to sit down and just sort of gather my thoughts and relax and plan the new year. But this has been an amazingly eventful year. The big events in terms of, I think, the movement and politics globally have been, first of all, COVID has sort of petered out. We hope it won't come back. The other thing starting in February was the Ukraine war, which has been very destructive, of course, of Ukraine, but of many other things, including destructive in our movement. And then I think the most exciting recent thing this year has been the takeover of Twitter by Elon Musk, which promised to open it up to more free speech. It's been pretty lackluster so far. I think he's sort of making it up as he goes along and trying to please too many people, including evil people who can't really be pleased and who fundamentally want him to fail. They don't want freedom of speech. So we'll see how that unfolds into the new year.
And then, of course, another fourth thing is the Kanye West debacle.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a debacle.
I say debacle. I could have said saga, storyline, yeah. Whatever you want.
Yeah, the Kanye controversy. Yeah, I think it's exciting, but that's sort of petering out, unless there's some news today that I haven't heard yet. But that was quite an exciting little chapter. I think that this could take Donald Trump out of politics, which would be honestly a good thing at this point. It might take down Nick Fuentes. It might take down Milo and a bunch of other people. And so I'm just sitting back and enjoying the spectacle, because not only is it destructive, but it's also destructive of the climate of taboos that we have to live under. And I like seeing that being shaken up. So I think it's a wonderful spectacle and a real opportunity, frankly, to kick against some of the limits on freedom of speech and freedom of thought, and especially provoke the establishment into overreacting, which is what trolling is all about, right? It's provoking a reaction that's often more illuminating, more educational than the initial troll itself. And I think that when a rapper says that Jews are really powerful people, most people don't take rappers seriously. I'm sorry. I certainly don't. But most people who pretend to take them seriously don't take them all that seriously, honestly. That's why they have to pretend. But when the ADL goes after his bank account and his endorsements and tries to ruin the guy's life, that's very educational, and people do take that seriously. So I think this is a very interesting spectacle playing out today.
Well, let's go through it chronologically, because I think it's worth it. It has been such an interesting, as I say, storyline, because and it's controversial within in a way that I don't really think it needed to be as controversial as it has been, but certain people have nailed their colors to the mast in different ways. And the other thing is it links sort of inexorably with the Twitter Elon Musk storyline as well. So
absolutely.
So let's start there, because I think that would be a good topic for you and me to focus on here. I think it was in about April or May that suddenly Elon Musk announced that he might buy Twitter. It was sometime around March, April, May. I can't remember. Sorry, I can't be more precise, but it doesn't really matter now. What were your first thoughts when you heard that Elon Musk might buy Twitter?
Well, I took my cue from the shrieking that started from leftists, and I thought, okay, this can't be so bad. Elon Musk is an interesting character. He's obviously not a leftist. He has certain rightist attitudes, or you could say libertarian attitudes. He's a free speech advocate. He is an advocate of radical technological progress, not, you know, moaning about Whitey on the moon and Whitey on Mars and stuff like that. He is a believer in eugenics. He's fathered at least 10 kids now, 9 of which are alive. The only failure from a eugenics point of view is that he didn't have a child or two with Tallulah Riley, but that's a separate issue, I guess. A minor failing on his part. But he's obviously not a leftist. And to have a non-leftist who has the biggest fortune in the world, the biggest private fortune in the world, taking over this platform could only be a good thing. Not necessarily a free speech utopia, certainly not necessarily what we would want, but certainly moving things in a better direction. And that is true. It has moved in a better direction. He's fired a lot of these people. He has also revealed all the stuff that we know was going on behind the scenes with the censorship and including collusion with the deep state, with the Democratic Party, with NGOs, with elements of the government itself, right? We knew that was going on. It's been exposed. This is very, very useful. He did a vote about an amnesty. The amnesty has not really happened. It's happened in a few cases. Just the other day, my personal normie Greg Johnson PhD Twitter account, which I've had for 10 years, maybe, was banned. They shut it down permanently.
Okay, so let's slow down a wee bit here, because that's obviously a very recent development, and I heard that happened, and I was quite shocked actually, because maybe it shouldn't be. I know that other people have been banned since he took over, but let's go through it stage by stage. So the rumors in May now, and you're right that he's clearly not one of us, so to speak, but he's very clearly not one of them either. He's a sort of centrist, libertarian, and that is relevant to what I think directly relevant to what's going on just now. And he seems to generally like the idea of free speech. He's not political in the way that, well, the previous custodians of Twitter were definitely rabidly political. He generally likes the idea of people being able to speak freely, but he's got this thing about extremists. And I remember him saying, like, back in May, when he was dipping his toe in the water of this, he was dropping hints, saying things. Hold on a second. In fact, I wrote a post about it at the time. But this was the 1st of May. And he said something like, authentication is important, but so is anonymity for many. A balance must be struck. And at the time, I noted that he seemed to be saying things that just to please different sections of the audience. So I sort of parodied this and said, vanilla ice cream is important, but so is strawberry for many. A balance must be struck. Kylie Minogue, but also Danny Minogue, and so forth, which is rather amusing. But I was getting at this idea that he's really not politically aligned. In a certain way, you might call him a normie. And as I say, he's got this thing about extremists. And I remember him saying at some point around then, it should be that the extreme right and the extreme left are equally unhappy with a platform. He said something like a platform.
Well, that's just sort of cowardly centrism, yeah.
Exactly. It's cowardly, unimaginative centrism. And Remnant Posting has been writing very good stuff about commentary on this matter more recently, as this attitude has manifested in Twitter. So the point is, he has this idea that reasonable ideas are in the center, and everything outside of that Overton window is by definition unreasonable. That's why it's not in the center ground. That's why it's extreme. By definition, something extreme and is unreasonable. Well, and that's, I mean, I can understand someone saying that. I can understand someone believing that who didn't really take things very seriously. Someone who thought that, I mean, I remember people saying with Brexit, yes, change needs to happen, but leaving the EU is too extreme a thing to do.
Yeah, well, I know. Extremism is a weasel word, basically. It's trying to penalize people for, you know, who are serious and consistent in their thinking from their basic premises. That is supposedly a bad thing. Instead, we have to be kind of muddled. We have to be very, very attentive to what everybody else around us is thinking and wanting, and not particularly concerned about what our ultimate principles are or where this is all going. It's just contemptible, really. But this is how we have a society that's governed by a kind of ever-shifting mobile hive mind consensus. And one of the things about Twitter is that Twitter is the platform where that ever-shifting mobile hive mind consensus gels. And therefore, it's one of the most important social media platforms in the world. We don't have any real leadership in Washington. We don't have any real sovereignty, if you want to use it in that term in that way. We don't have people making decisions. We don't have people who are accountable. We don't have people who are responsible. We just have a hive mind that reconstitutes its consensus every second on social media platforms, predominantly Twitter. And
No, indeed. And this gets to the other aspect of it. We talked about Elon Musk. We can now talk about Twitter. And this was done at the time. I talked about it extensively when I was banned from it 4 years ago. So it's not a topic that's new to people. But I think since it's been very relevant this year, we could do to talk about it here. I see, because people will say, well, Twitter isn't real life. And I think that's a ridiculous, I'm sorry, but I really think that's a ridiculous thing to say. Of course it's not real life. Of course it's not the general public. That's not the point. It's also not I'm sure that the Rothschilds don't go on Twitter to find out what to do next, or whoever you want to say is controlling the world. So in that sense,
I don't think there's anybody controlling the world. We're all asleep at the wheel, basically. But go ahead.
Well, either way, the point that I'm making here is Twitter is important to a huge number of people, movers and shakers, opinion formers, the promulgators of the consensus. And it is where the consensus is sort of cooked up, and especially especially the justifications for the consensus, the bullshit rationale for the consensus. It tends to be cooked up on Twitter. So, and definitely spread there. So that's one of the reasons it's so relevant and important a platform. It's not like Facebook or Instagram or even YouTube. Twitter is quite unique, and I'm actually amazed that they let it fall into enemy hands, so to speak. I'm surprised that it wasn't more closely guarded, because I mean, I don't think Google will ever sell YouTube. I don't think that the Meta Corporation will ever sell Facebook or Instagram. But Twitter was allowed to fall into out of ownership of the regime, so to speak. And so the other relevant thing about it is it's where people like us can easily interact with, for example, BBC journalists, politicians, authors, academics, journalists, and so on. So again, it's unique in this way. So Greg, what would you like to talk about Twitter in that context?
Well, yeah, I do think it's important. I don't know where it's going to go. I do think it is a psyop, definitely. And it is interesting that a psyop would not be more closely guarded and kept out of the hands of somebody who's a bit of a maverick. But, you know, money talks in this oligarchy, and the people who run the oligarchy are very, very used to disciplining billionaires, which we've seen with Kanye West, right? Kanye West was in the billionaire league, and now he's not.
Yeah, yeah. But let's get to that later. I want to go through this chronologically, because there is so much that we could miss if we skip around. But with Twitter, it was one of these places where billionaires actually... And it's actually funny you say that, because I remember Elon Musk about a year ago being taken to task by Jonathan Greenblatt for something. I don't know what it was he said or did. And Jonathan Greenblatt gave him a dressing down publicly. And Elon Musk actually apologized. He actually said sorry publicly to Jonathan Greenblatt about a year ago. So this is, it sort of really plays to your point that it's where there are powers that are accustomed to telling billionaires what to do and what to say and what not to say and what not to think and so on.
I'm sort of out of thoughts about this personally. I'm just sort of watching and waiting and watching. I don't think I'll ever get my personal account back. I don't think the Countercurrents account will ever be brought back. I think it's bizarre that Spencer was never thrown off the platform. I think it's bizarre that Andrew Anglin is back on the platform. I really don't understand the logic of it all, and I don't think there's any logic to it, honestly. I just think that Musk is making up as he goes along, and there are lots of other cooks in the kitchen who are acting independently and at cross purposes with one another. And who knows what this train wreck is going to bring us. It's maybe it won't be a train wreck, but it's certainly all balled up at the head office right now at Twitter.
Well, it has. I think it's already a bit of a train wreck. But what happened next is that there was a sort of ongoing confusion about whether this deal would go through or not. Then I think in, I don't know, about September or August, it was suddenly announced that it was going ahead. He took possession of Twitter, I think in about October. It's all moved so fast. And then immediately the old guard were fired. Vijaya, I've forgotten her name now. Then Yoel Roth, the Jewish, I think he was the head of trust and safety or something like that. And there were lots of, you know, learn to code jibes being thrown around. And then everyone sort of waited. And then the ADL started immediately, actually, got very irate. And I think this was a big mistake on their part. I mean, I'm sure you would have something to say about the ADL and their conduct this year. But it's all, again, it's all wrapped up with the Kanye West thing as well. It's sort of simultaneous. So at some point, Kanye West made this announcement that he was going to go DEFCON 3 or something on Jews. And he said that on Twitter. And this was simultaneous with Elon Musk taking Twitter over. So people were thinking it's like an acid test. How Elon Musk reacts to that is going to dictate, it's going to characterize his custodianship of Twitter.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Because they are the elephant in the room. They are the most powerful group in our society. They are the people you cannot offend. And immediately Kanye is rushing out there with 30 million followers and going DEFCON 3 on them. And honestly, if I were scripting this, if I were the chess master here, if I had any influence at all, I would have definitely encouraged Kanye not to do this. Let's wait a while and see how this shakes out. The last thing that Elon Musk needs the day after the ink is dry practically is the Jewish establishment going ballistic and going DEFCON 3 on Twitter. That's the last thing he needed. But, you know, you can't control people. I have no influence on Kanye West. And so, you know, it happened. It might be a fateful thing because, you know, if we had crept up on freedom of speech and on the JQ rather than had this direct assault on it right out of the gate, we might have gotten more of what we wanted. But this is just speculation. I really don't know.
Well, yeah. The other aspect to it from the point of view of the ADL is that I think if they'd gone about this in a more delicate manner, they would have come out looking much better than they currently do. I think that Jonathan Greenblatt has shown an incredible lack of tact and diplomacy and willingness to compromise. I mean, I guess you could say that they've had their way for so long that they've forgotten the need to compromise. And maybe forgotten how to compromise. I mean, you know, people were saying that Abe Foxman, for example, would have handled this much better than Jonathan Greenblatt. What would you say about that?
I think so. I do think Greenblatt is sort of the international creep out of central casting. He looks like Nosferatu. He was a terrible choice from an optics point of view. And he's very, very shrill and aggressive. He's very, very pushy. He has a lot of stereotypical negative traits that he brings to the table. And so he's a terrible face, actually, for the Jewish establishment. Terrible face in all kinds of ways. And yeah, honestly, if I had been them, I would have just remained silent about the Kanye West thing because it's their reaction that is most newsworthy. It's not rappers going off about Jews, because that happens every few years quite predictably. And Kanye isn't the first, right? It's the reaction that creates the news and creates the discussion. And also, I think the reaction is kind of red-pilling. I think the reaction is far more red-pilling than anything Kanye West said, which is a lot of it's just incoherent and stupid stuff about blacks being the real Jews and things like that. That's all kind of dumb, It's just flat out dumb. It's Kang's dumb stuff. But when the ADL says, we're going to get him, We got to get him. We got to nip this in the bud. And suddenly he's losing all of his endorsement contracts and he's losing his bank. Suddenly people wake up and they say, gee, there's something to this Jewish power claim. They might not have put any weight on Kanye West's words. They might not think he's very credible as a source. But the events instituted, put in motion by the ADL after his comments, really give weight to what he's saying. Give more weight to what he's saying than his actual statements.
Oh, absolutely. They've proven him right. That's the thing. That's the key thing here. Is they have dismantled his life. And after he's claimed, because he's claimed that they have the ability to dismantle his life. So I don't know. I don't know how they could have thought that was a good idea.
Yeah, Joe Sobrin put it really well. He said that basically the code is that you have to pretend that Jews are a very weak and fragile people who are constantly in danger of extermination, that they have no power and they've got no influence. And if you don't do that, they will destroy you. And it's an absurd farce that everybody knows about. Everybody who's anybody in America knows about Jewish power, and they also know that they can't talk about it. And I thought that far, far better than anything Kanye West said was the Dave Chappelle monologue on Saturday Night Live, where he laid it out. He said, these are the rules. The rules are, if they're Black, it's a gang. If they're Italians, it's the mob. And if they're Jews, it's a coincidence, and we must never speak of it. That was brilliant. That was absolutely brilliant. And that went out there live on Saturday night. And once people get that template into their mind, once they wrap their minds around it, they will not be able to unsee what is visible to them. They will see every single day confirmation of that, because those are the rules. And those are the rules because the people who are in charge of our society, the most powerful people in our society, don't want to be accountable. They want to be invisible. They want to intimidate you from noticing what's going on. You can't notice any patterns here, or you're an evil person. Why do they want to do that? Because that helps maintain their power. End of story. It's very simple.
Yeah. I mean, the Dave Chappelle thing was an interesting sort of sub episode within all of this, this whole thing. And I think he handled it very well. I think he did very well. I talked about it on my weekly show, and it perhaps was not quite as positive about it as I could have been, but I do think he handled it very well. It was an extremely difficult position for him to be in, but I don't know what the ramifications of that will be for Dave Chappelle, actually. But I know that the ADL were, again, moaning about it. Jonathan Greenblatt moaning about it. That seems to be their only technique at this point.
Yeah, they've gotten really lazy. But the other thing is that I think their power is waning. And that's very, very positive. So I'm quite encouraged by this. I'm quite encouraged by what's happened with the Kanye saga. I think it's been very educational. I have some hope that things will get better on Twitter, even though I will not be participating in it. And honestly, I don't like Twitter. I never liked the platform all that much anyway. But as soon as he owned it, as soon as he bought it, I said, I'm going to go on there and just test how free this platform is. And my followers went up into like the 2300 range, and then I got canceled, basically. So
Have you any idea of what you got canceled for? Was there a pretext?
First of all, I got a text message or an email from them saying, we are required to inform you if in the country of Germany people are complaining about you. And there was some comment that was complained about that was just totally innocuous. It was just bizarre. But you know that, you know, some blue-haired people were flagging away, basically. But the thing that they took me down on was the video clip from my Kanye talk, the audio version. Okay, we put a little short video of a clip from my audio version of my Kanye piece with some images of various people. And it was put out there with the title, Is Kanye West Crazy? Or Kanye West is Crazy, or something like that. And it was very effective. It was just a short clip where I explained why you'd have to be a little crazy if you were a rich person in America to talk about Jewish power. But you know, I was defending Kanye. Well, that was the pretext for taking it down. I thought it was pretty eloquent. I'm glad somebody got upset about it, frankly. But somebody very powerful got upset about it, and they squelched my freedom of speech. So much for freedom of speech on Twitter.
Well, and that leads to another thing that Elon has said, which is that he really doesn't like the idea of lifetime bans. So,
well, it's a permanent ban. You know, if he doesn't like the idea, he can change it. He owns the place, but they say it's a permanent ban. I've appealed it, but I appealed my countercurrents ban years ago, and there was no acknowledgement of it. And the pretext for my countercurrents ban was utterly silly. It was just totally silly. It couldn't stand up for a moment of thought. I was banned there.
Well, that in turn leads to the release of the Twitter files, which Elon Musk has been releasing over the last few days, which show that they really were. I mean, everyone knew, people like us knew this full well. It's no surprise to us that they were simply suiting themselves. They were simply bending the rules, inventing new rules, new policies, reinterpreting policies to get rid of people that they didn't like. It was as simple as that. And now that was obvious, but it was not acknowledged. Now, of course, the question is, so what? That it has now been acknowledged. It's now been said. The evidence is out there. But the power structure has the choice whether to do something about this, its own corruption, or to just ignore it. And, what do you expect to happen here with the release of the Twitter files, which relate to all sorts of issues, especially Hunter Biden's laptop and so on?
Oh, yeah. Well, sadly, the only champions of good sense, at least putative champions of good sense and good government in America, are the Republicans. And they're the best at this system has to offer us right now, and the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. We just have a bunch of weaklings to press this case, and so I don't expect much to come out of this on a legislative level. There aren't that many voices that will broadcast the meaning of this to the general public. Tucker Carlson is probably the best that we've got, so I don't expect a lot to happen. I just expect there to be more cynicism. And it's an open question in my mind about cynicism. Does cynicism make the system weaker or more powerful? I think it kind of does both. If you don't believe anything that anyone says, that the authorities say, that makes it harder for them to get obedience, right? It makes it harder for them to get obedience without coercion. And that raises the cost of government. They have to work harder to get their way because people don't trust them. Okay. So that makes their job harder. But if cynicism goes too far, then there can be no resistance that gels against the establishment either. And this is why I look on people like Alex Jones as quite possibly a system psyop, because if you take these people seriously, everything's fake. You can't trust anyone. You'd certainly be a fool to trust Alex Jones, but they trust him. And so you're living in a simulation. Everything's fake. The system has enormous power. You can't trust anybody. Why resist, right? So I think that cynicism, if it goes too far, actually just disintegrates society to the point where the people who have the most cards right now will always be able to get their way. So I'm of two minds about this. But I do see the trajectory is that as people become less and less willing to believe and peaceably comply with the narratives and the orders that are put forward from the center, that there'll be much more coercion involved. And that's the direction that society's going in, sadly. Whether or not the wheels are going to come off before things become intolerable, I don't know. We know that an unsustainable system won't go on forever, but the only question is, will it go on long enough that it's really not possible for anything better to come after it and replace it?
Well, yeah, that's a huge question. But just for now, the mention of Alex Jones is interesting, because something that I've noticed is you've got at least, there are probably more, but there are at least three people who are associated with the alt-light in 2016-17. Alex Jones, Gavin McInnes, and Jordan Peterson, who are still very relevant now and still active now. And they've got involved with the Kanye West thing and have really fought for the power structure and tried to dissuade Kanye. Like, Alex Jones had him on the interview. It's just a sort of bizarre, like, nonsense with the fishing net and the Yahoo and the stupid voice that Kanye was doing. And Alex Jones was trying to tell him, no, it's not about the Jews. I knew a German guy who, or my grandfather was screwed over by a German guy, a capitalist, a ruthless capitalist. So it's not fair to blame the Jews for things like this. It's just absurd. Like, this, you've got a massive star who has effectively done the work for you, and instead you work against that guy and try to tell him that he's wrong. He's taken the leap for you so that you don't have to be the first one to do it. And in the case of Alex Jones, you're already fucked. You're already in, is it billions of dollars that he owes for the Sandy Hook stuff. You're already completely vilified. There is even a verb, Alex Jones, to have been Alex Jones, because of how badly you've already been treated. So all of that has already happened. You've not got much left to lose. And yet, even in that situation, you still side with the power structure.
Well, that's what he believes. What he believes. He believes in sort of... I hate to use the boomer meme, but sort of boomer conservatism. It's Milton Friedman plus Martin Luther King, right? Nonsense. The dream of Dr. King of a race blind society. I don't care what people's colors are, as long as they have the right principles. He believes that stuff. Sadly, he believes that, and he's going to believe it till he dies. And there's a new generation of people coming up that don't believe that narrative anymore. And there's a changing of the guards, a generational changing of the guards that's definitely going on. But that's what Alex Jones believes. That's what a lot of people believe. Now, maybe he's not sincere, but that's where he thinks the money is, or maybe somebody's got blackmail photos or whatever. People can come up with all kinds of, sort of invidious, claims about his real motives. But why even go there? I know plenty of people who believe that nonsense. They sincerely believe it. They think that they have a picture in their mind of a workable America where people believe that nonsense. If they could just roll back the clock a little bit to that particular time. And we have to break them out of this delusion, because there's nothing good that's going to come out of basically casting sand in the eyes of people who start noticing patterns about the real power structure in our society. We're not going to go forward by being blind and being stupid. And that's really what this colorblind civic nationalism is. This conservative colorblind civic nationalism is just principled dogmatic blindness and stupidity.
Yes. And that brings us to Gavin McInnes, because he then interviewed Kanye West. And, the thing about Gavin McInnes is that there are clips of him talking about his brainwashing trip to Israel that he went on with rebel media under Ezra Levant. It's very clear that he knows a lot of things and knew them years ago, which he now denies. The lack of principle there is just astonishing. So he interviewed Kanye West, and he's sitting there trying to dissuade him of things that are obviously true and which he himself obviously knows are true. It's disgusting.
I've met him. I've seen him in action. He's just a consummate narcissist and wall cow. He knows a lot of the facts. He's read Kevin MacDonald. And yet he tries to do this stuff. I watched the trailer for his interview where he says, "I'm flying out to save Ye." And I watched some clips from it. And I almost thought, you know, this is almost a parody of the establishment, right? It's so transparently dumb and dishonest. I was thinking, you know, is he really on our side? Is he really trying to discredit Kanye, or is he trying to discredit these lame civic nationalist individualist? If they're black, it's a gang. If they're Italians, it's a mob. If they're Jews, it's a coincidence, and we can never speak of it. It almost came off as a parody of that. Oh, let's just call them globalists, right? Let's just call them liberals. Oh, they're white people. It's interesting. He will not talk about Jews as a collective except to praise them, but he's perfectly willing to collectivize and denigrate white people, right? Oh, they're white liberals.
I couldn't believe it when it got to that point in the interview where he said that. That Jews are, I forgot what it was. He said something like there's a suicide gene in white people that just spontaneously causes them to self-destruct once they become too powerful.
Yeah, right.
And that Jews are white people. And that, I've forgotten that it got a stage even more absurd than that, where Jews being liberal whites cause whites to self-destruct, or something like that.
Yeah, well... He's dropping some red pills in there and behaving like an absolute jackass at the same time. And I don't know if that's his intention or if he's just so lost, if he's so far up his own ass, he doesn't know what's going on. But I was very amused by what I saw of that. I didn't watch the whole thing because it's just too painful to watch this guy. He's such a clown. So, but I was actually thinking, is he trying to parody this sort of boomer civic nationalist paradigm? It almost sounds like a parody the way he lays it out.
It
there.
Really seems too. It seems too late for this kind of thinking now. This kind of nonsense. This is. I hate to say it, but it's current year. It's 2022. It's not 2015. It's definitely not 1995. You know, we don't need to be lying. Not that I'm saying that it was ever necessary to lie, but the point, you can see what I mean. Gavin McInnes doesn't need to be this dishonest in this time, you know, in the same way that Alex Jones doesn't need to be this dishonest. I get it, with him you think that he really believes this stuff. I think you're probably right about that, but with Gavin McInnes we know for a fact that he knows better. And that is what I find so egregious about all of this, that he's acting baffled when Kanye West says things that we know he knows are true.
Yeah. Gavin is not as stupid as Alex Jones is. He's just very dishonest. And I don't ultimately know what his game is or how he thinks this is all going to work out. He's a very dishonest guy. These are the words that I got banned from Twitter for speaking in a little clip that was posted to my Twitter account. Every serious person in America today knows that Jews are the most powerful and privileged group in society. But if you openly acknowledge that fact, they will destroy you. Jews are the ones are one of the most densely networked and collectivist groups in America today. But you aren't allowed to notice that fact. They can act as a team, but we have to pretend that they are just individuals. As Dave Chappelle put it, if they're black, it's a gang. If they're Italian, it's a mob. If they're Jewish, it's a coincidence, and we must never speak about it. We also have to pretend that we have no idea where any of this is going. I'll tell you where it's going. Since a team strategy beats an individualist strategy every time, the only place this is going is a tighter and tighter Jewish stranglehold until America finally expires from decadence and diversity. But it all ends when white people start noticing and taking our own side. We can't fix America without discussing the so-called Jewish question. If every important person in America today knows about Jewish power, why don't they just speak out about it? It's complicated, but the main reason is lack of solidarity. They all know that the game would be up if enough of them would speak out at the same time, but somebody has to go first, and nobody wants to be first because these people have more rivals than friends, and they know that their rivals would scramble to denounce them for speaking the truth. Why overthrow an unjust power structure when you can simply suck up a notch or two by denouncing braver, more principled men? Thus, a prominent American would have to be nuts to speak out about the Jews. Enter Kanye West. Those are the words that got me banned from Twitter. That's crossing the line even on Elon Musk's platform. That's too much freedom of speech for Elon's platform today.
Well, this is the thing about the center. You know, he is a centrist. He is basically enabling or creating a new centrist orthodoxy, which is kind of useless, frankly, because it means, well, you can't say the truth because the truth is extreme. And the truth, yeah. The thing is, in outrage, the truth is often extreme. I wish I lived in a boring age where the truth was kind of bland and sayable by anyone without great cost. It's just sort of pedestrian. But unfortunately, I don't. I live in an age of great corruption and wickedness. And that is the truth. And pointing it out requires saying things that the asleep would call extreme.
Absolutely.
It's unfortunate, but
it's beautifully said, but that's the truth. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is why we need freedom of speech. You know, no one needs freedom of speech to say
happy things. We need freedom of speech to say things that upset people in power. That's why we have freedom of speech. That's why we need it.
Exactly.
We need freedom of speech to bring bad news to people in power who don't want to hear it and who punish people for bearing bad news. So we cannot punish bearers of bad news if we want a workable society. That's simply a basic truth, and that's the justification for freedom of speech. But we can't speak about the people who are really in power. This idea that you want to know who rules you, who is the person you cannot insult, right? That's a trait of powerful people. And that's a pathological trait of powerful people because it makes a society brittle and subject to catastrophic failure if you can't tell uncomfortable truths to people in the position to make important decisions.
Absolutely. And I think this was the hope that people had about Elon Musk taking over Twitter. And definitely I did. Someone's just commented in the chat, until we can openly discuss these matters, Elon's advocacy of free speech is quite frankly BS. I would agree with that. I mean, and I can imagine someone saying, oh, come on, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. It's good enough what Elon's doing. But it's really not. I mean, it's, I don't want to name names, but there are content creators who make a living, quite a handsome living, from pretending to be outrageous. And they'll say things that are not quite acceptable, but are still perfectly tolerable, that they're not actually a threat. And I think you're going to end up with a similar situation on Twitter where, okay, you can moan about political correctness. Well, big fucking deal.
Yeah. It's the hokey pokey, right? You know, you put your right foot in, take your right foot out, you put your right foot in, you shake it all about, and you go right up to the line you make a little face and you act like you're being naughty and you drop a little bit of truth and then you take your foot back out and you be a good boy for a while. It's a disgusting spectacle and it's highly, highly monetizable. Definitely.
No, certainly. As I say, monetize. Yeah, you can make a living from doing that, from pretending to be controversial.
Tim Pool. Names are gone.
Tim Pool, well,
Tim Pool was also a player in this whole Kanye thing.
Indeed.
He was an absolute wall cow too.
You know,
it's a mark of how, like a parody.
It's a mark of how bland he is that he didn't even occur to me. I was thinking of the others.
But what's under that stupid hat anyway? Come on, Tim.
Well, everyone's got quirks. I don't want to go for the hat, but
a man in a blue bathrobe cannot throw stones at a man wearing a hat, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But I do find, again, what happened on that Kanye West interview that he did was just disastrous for him, not for Kanye West. I think it was a terrible, and JF did an excellent analysis of it. And it's interesting, even if you're not interested in that whole thing about, you know, Kanye West and whatever, JF's analysis of it is interesting just on just for psychological value. What was going on in the sort of interdynamics between the two men during that very brief time? I think it was only 21 minutes. So I would definitely recommend that to people. I shared it on my Telegram a week ago or so. But yeah, he is another one who I suspect that Tim Pool is kind of like Alex Jones, that he's just not that bright. And I think he might well believe what he says.
Well, I think he believes what he says, and he sees where the dollars are coming from. And so when you have a really good living, you're in a kind of comfy sweet spot. A lot of people won't question things that would threaten a really good living. It's just the truth. It's just human psychology, right?
I mean, I can understand someone enjoying a good living, but just do it. Just talk about films or something. Talk about the weather. Don't have your money, have your wealth, and the endless stream of thoughts coming in, and whatever. But don't pretend to be controversial. Don't pretend, and don't counter-signal and attack those who have more integrity than you. Just enjoy the money and shut up, basically. That's what I wish some people like Tim Pool would do.
Right. So, yeah, I think it's been a great year so far. And it's an interesting ride, put it that way. I kind of feel helpless with the Twitter thing. But I'm very, very excited that there are people with much bigger audiences, huge fortunes, great fame, like Kanye West, who are going out there and trolling the establishment into some very, very educational reactions. That's been a great, I think, progress that we've had this year. I'm very excited about it. So I am grateful for that. I'm grateful for what Kanye has done. I'm grateful to some extent for what Elon Musk has done. He has objectively made things better in terms of free speech, but it's not good enough if I'm not enjoying it. So I want more freedom. But I think that these are two positive things, definitely. And after COVID, and after this war and everything, I really wanted some good news. So these are a couple of things that I think have objectively improved the situation, and they might continue to improve things into the new year. We can only wait and see.
What I will say about the Twitter thing, just one final point about it, is I always said I will only go back on if I get the original Millennial Wars account back, because the sock accounts... Or any, I mean, I could create new sock accounts, but what's the point? I don't want to, I'm not famous, but I am a public figure, and I need the official account. Otherwise, it's worthless. And I might as well, I could be an anon. There's nothing wrong with that. But I've got too much to do to be an anon. I don't want that, to spending loads of time on Twitter. What I want is the official account that I can use for making announcements. About millennial streams, for example. Other than that, it's not really worth it for me. And shitposting and insulting people, it used to be fun on Twitter, but again, it's not a productive use of my time. And I honestly don't miss it. At a certain point, after I think like the fourth sock account, I just decided I cannot be bothered with this anymore, that I could be having a different life, I could be having a better life. And And I was right. And so I just didn't create a new one. And I've never missed it, never looked back. So that's my thing. And it's still my policy that I will, you know, if I get the original account back, I will use it. But otherwise, no. And as things stand, I don't feel confident that I'll get the original account back. So it's, I don't care. I honestly don't care.
I'm honestly in the same position as you. It's a Skinner box, right? Once I got back on, I started tuning in multiple times a day. I started looking to see if my number of followers was going up. I started looking at my like counts, and I just thought, this is a fake world. This is a game where you get fake dopamine, or you get real dopamine for fake achievements in their little game world. And that's fundamentally a definition of a waste of time, to me, an online waste of time. And of course, there are many, many online wastes of time out there, and it's engineered to be an addictive, empty calorie online waste of time. So yeah, I don't miss it all that much, but it is a thing. And, way back when the alt-right was schooling libs for the first time and actually challenging these people in their little bubble world. It was a beautiful thing. It was quite enjoyable, but that was long, long ago. I don't think we're ever going to get that back, sadly.
Yes, unfortunately. Well, we're coming up on the hour. Is there anything that you'd like to make people aware of that CounterCurrents has been up to over this year?
Well, yeah. The big thing I've done in 2022 was I created a public policy institute, which we're going to roll out in the new year. We started work on it in January. We created a corporation. We wrote the corporate charter with approval by the United States Internal Revenue Service in mind as a 501c3 tax-exempt charity. And we got approval in October. So we went through this whole process of building an institution, and we did it right. It got approved. We have a bank account. We have everything is falling into place, and we're going to get a website and get rolled out early in January. That's the plan. So that's a big accomplishment. We have a new institution, and I'd love to talk more about that when we actually can officially sort of raise the curtain on it, but that's huge news.
What would it do? I mean, what a policy institute could you do? Because some people won't know what that means exactly.
For years I've been sort of snarkily saying, wouldn't it be nice if we had a sort of national policy institute that would put out position papers and craft policies and do polls, do social scientific polling, do policy studies about, say, the negative consequences of diversity and multiculturalism and open borders and globalization on historically defined communities and historically defined homelands. And I finally just said, you know, I can create such a thing. I've created institutions before. I know how it's done. And I thought at the end of last year, I'd raised more than $200,000 in our fundraiser. And I thought, you know, I'm starting to gather a bit of clout. Maybe I could start an institution and actually raise a few $100,000 and create a budget for it and get a full staff of professionals to do the kind of policy institute work that we really should be doing. Deep dives into the public consciousness to try and understand where people are, to try and understand where people have agreement with us, but also where they have reservations. And then work with focus groups to try and overcome those reservations, to change our messaging, to come up with better messaging, better ways of moving the public mind in our direction. Everybody does this except us, and yet we think we're doing the most important thing in the world. And so it's time for us to have that kind of institution with a professional staff and the ability to do that sort of work. So that's the big thing I did this year.
How can people help with that?
Well, they can give money. That's the main thing. We have a fundraiser that's coming to an end at the end of the year. We're trying to raise $300,000 this year. And that is going to paying me and paying my staff. I now have 10 people working for me, most of them part-time, but I have 10 employees. That's a lot of people besides myself that are supported by Countercurrents. And we have managed to create this institution this year and keep Countercurrents going. And that's no mean thing. We had our best year in terms of traffic, definitely. So I'm very, very happy about that. We published 9 books. A 10th is going to be out in a week or two. I've published, I think, my 18th book, which is my 5th film anthology. I'm readying a couple more books for press in the new year. One is called The Trial of Socrates. The other is called The Great Replacement. Our biggest publishing thing in 2022 was Francis Parker Yockey's book, The Enemy of Europe, which brings this book back literally from the ashes. It was destroyed by the liberal democracy of West Germany on orders from the United States government. But a few copies survived in German, and we have managed to reverse translate it into English and bring out the German and English together in a really handsome edition. Next year, by this time, we'll have brought out a new annotated, critical, really spiffy edition of Yockey's Magnum Opus Imperium, and that'll complete our Francis Parker Yockey complete works in 3 volumes. So these are things that are going on. We've been very, very busy at Countercurrents in front of the stage, right, in front of the curtain, but behind the scenes, we've been doing a whole lot of stuff too. So it's been a great year. I'm looking back at it and kind of in awe of all the stuff that we've accomplished. We had a great conference. We had a weekend conference in October in Atlanta. There were 67 people. We had Kevin McDonald there. We had Jim Goad there speaking. James Edwards spoke. Who else? Sam Dixon spoke. Nathan D'Amigo. Nathan D'Amigo is so back, right? He's back in the game, and he spoke at our conference. The video is up on our channel and on the front page of Countercurrents. And a number of other Countercurrents writers spoke at the event too. I spoke as well. So it was a very, very solid event. It was the first conference I've done in years. Well, COVID really shut a lot of stuff down in 2020 and 2021. And so we finally were able to organize a weekend conference for 2022. And we'll be doing another one next year, definitely.
Yeah, the Countercurrents retreats.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So it's been a great year. I'm rather impressed, actually, by how much we've accomplished. And we have a great team. That's the thing. And the main change at Countercurrents was hiring Cyan Quinn as my program director. She came from VDARE, and she is just a powerhouse. She's extremely energetic. She was a professional office manager for an insurance company before she came on board. And so she knew all the office manager magic that I could only guess at. And so over the past year, there's a long list of improvements to Countercurrents operations that she's made, and she's brought in a number of people. We have our own secure database. It's our own program, so we're not depending on these these programs that you basically lease space on somebody else's server and put all your sensitive information on. Even if they would take us, it's still very risky. We don't want to do that. So we created our own database. We have done a lot of work behind the scenes with streamlining our operations and payment processing and everything. So yeah, it's been a fantastic year.
Oh, I'm glad. Congratulations. There are some comments, super chats that I'll read out. Irish Nationalist Media says, Greg Johnson is one of our very best. Thank you and Countercurrents for helping the cause through all these years and speaking to woes. Our people's best years are ahead of us, and we will live to see it. Well, thank you very much. That's very optimistic and encouraging.
Thank you.
I should say Countercurrents has been going for 12 years now, and you did the 12th anniversary stream earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a thing. Okay.
Dissident Echoes writes, Greg, I heard you say once you'd like to get David Cole to write for Countercurrents as a replacement based J-pilled Jews in our thing. It turns out that David Cole, quote, hates Countercurrents. You can just imagine him saying that. So I don't think there's any chance of getting David Cole writing for Countercurrents.
Oh, that's a shame.
I mean, yeah, it's sad. I do think he's very talented, but he's obviously a mess. Highly neurotic, right, and drinks way too much, but still talented, and he's in a nice niche over at Taki Mag. I stole Taki's best writer, Jim Goad. I can leave them Cole as a consolation.
All right. Someone says, me too, says, Millennial Woes, in an ideal world, would you want Twitter to exist? That's a really difficult question. I think in an ideal world, there would be no need for Twitter to exist. So I guess the answer is no. But in our world, Twitter is potentially a very useful tool. So, mm-hmm. and I would say the same about social media in general. I don't really think, in an ideal world, social media wouldn't exist. You'd have academics, intellectuals, and so on communicating online, and ordinary people would be communicating with the other people in their local area. Be the life of the village, the shire kind of thing. So social media for normies, I think, is toxic. I've said this before. I think it's generally a destructive thing for ordinary people. And it's not great for intellectuals either, frankly. It's definitely not good for celebrities. In an ideal world, celebrities wouldn't really exist. You'd have aristocrats instead, people who actually deserve to be celebrated, not vacuous right. non-entities and bimbos and morons. Short answer, no. In an ideal world, I wouldn't want Twitter to exist. But in our world, it could be critically useful, important to us. So that's that. Paladin says, and with a very generous donation, thank you very much. Fantastic show. Merry Christmas to everybody watching. Thank you very much, Paladin. Merry Christmas to you. Gigaduck says, another year, another millennial. Great shows already this year, Woes and guests. Thank you for doing this. Thank you very much. You're welcome. Maximus Gibbs says, here's an advance on my 200k reparations check, cracker. Well, thank you, Maximus Gibbs. That's a brilliant name as well.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah.
Okay. Here's a question to end with, and this comes from SF, and he says, "Greg, Woes keeps saying, he's roped me into this. Woes keeps saying that our concerns won't have teeth until the elites share them. Where does that leave dissident right thought leaders like yourself? Are we supposed to sit back and wait until an elite that agrees with our views seizes power? On this view, nothing we do individually or collectively makes any difference." Greg, you take that question.
Well, I'm very, very critical of sort of very kind of glib elitism. There's a lot of glib elitism in our ranks. There's a lot of glib elitism. For instance, there's this book by academic agent Nima Parvini called The Populist Delusion, which is basically a rehearsal of elite theorists. I wrote a critique of that at Countercurrents. I hope somebody can link it in the chat, where I talk about why I don't agree with that. I'm a populist. I do think the people have power. The people have power, if only to the extent that even the establishment pays lip service to democracy and popular representation. Of course, they do everything they can to hollow that out and make it into a farce, but they're not so arrogant that they just want to dispense with it entirely and openly. So I think that we need to use every tool possible, including demanding that these people who uphold the idea of popular sovereignty actually listen to the people. And that is a way that you can get everybody involved, a lot of people involved. And that's why it's important to speak to as broad a public as we can. The idea that all change comes from the top down, it's just a dogma. The idea that all change has to be sponsored by elites and oligarchs, that's just an NRX dogma. And because these people have this dogma, this is why Yarvin wrote his Clear Pill essay. What's the Clear Pill? Just do nothing and let us work on the elites. That's how the future is going to be secured. That's just rubbish. That's nonsense. I think that, yes, we do want to change the elites. We want the elites to circulate. We want to become the new elites. And we do want to find people who think our way, who are already part of the establishment, convert them, right? We can convert people in the establishment. We can also find fresh, open-minded young people who are on a trajectory to being very, very influential, and we can convert them and send them out into the world to, do their thing, to do their elite things. That's definitely part of the program. But I think we need to speak as broadly as possible to everybody while we do that and have messages that resonate with everybody, the broad public and really, really smart people. At Countercurrents, I very consciously decided early on that I wanted a website that will appeal to people with IQs of 120 and above, right? Why? Because those people are going to be disproportionately influential on the future of society. And so, yeah, I do understand that we want better than average people. We want elites. But the idea that we have to appeal to existing elites, or that we have to basically just be quiet and let Curtis Yarvin whisper in enough ears or something, I think it's just really silly. We're not going to become a counter elite by just whispering in corners and talking to ourselves. We're going to become a counter elite by broadcasting our message to the whole world and attracting really, really bright people to get involved. But we should also be very willing to engage in populist politics, including populist grievance mongering politics. I think that is very, very important. National populism is the wave of the future, and we should be directing national populism. We should be aligning ourselves with the existing forces of national populism and trying to guide them to a better destination.
All right. Excellent. Well, that seems like a good note to end on. Okay, I'll be back in about an hour with The Course of Empire. We'll talk about Canada and the trucker convoy and so on. But in the meantime, Greg Johnson, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2022.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to Millennial 2023. And I hope to have lots of wonderful things to report then. Also, if you want to tune over to the Writer's Block, Whitgard is on with Nick Gilvey talking about Christmas lore, European Christmas lore. I have to give them a plug. Folks, I really appreciate you listening. We've had a really nice big audience here. There's been some really good comments. There's one comment I want to respond to, which is that it's too late to build institutions. I don't believe that for a minute. I don't think it's 5 minutes to midnight. I think we could have decades ahead of us, and that we need to actually have good functioning institutions so that we can influence the political change. I think we can do that. I think we should have built these institutions 20 or 30 years ago. We did build one almost 20 years ago, the National Policy Institute, but that was just ruined. So we've learned our lessons, and we're back, and we're going to do it again. And I think that this could have decades of productive life ahead of us and be very, very helpful for creating a better future for white people in the world.
Okay. Well, I hope so. And I hope that people support that, and that you can come back next year and tell us about the progress that it's made.
Yeah, absolutely. So Merry Christmas, everyone, and be of good cheer.
Okay. All right. I'll be back soon. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.